through me. Don't you understand? Oh, my little girl. All I ever wanted, all I ever needed is here.
Now, welcome to Stop the Presses on the 8th of December, 2021. Your host, Mark Anderson, coming to you live. And due to popular demand, more video views than we've had in a long time, perhaps ever, at the live stream video component, the simulcast of this show. Due to that, I'm returning on the air with Brian David Anderson, my longtime colleague, investigating the unexplored, largely uncharted corners of the JFK so-called assassination on November 22nd, 1963. We last did this on November 22nd, 2021. To hit that anniversary, and those that have listened to this or seen it, depending on whether you looked at the audio only or the video simulcast, know that we postulate, in fact, we believe very strongly, and we look at it from a court of law's point of view, that beyond a reasonable doubt, JFK did not die that day, that it was a abdication or fake assassination by abdication, or you might say abdication by fake assassination, and that it was a cloak and dagger operation that was carried out to look like a assassination by rifle fire. And the dichotomy, the polarity that they create, it had to have been an assassination by rifle fire, and it's only a question of where the shot came from, is the perfect way to cover something like this up, because that's how it works. They want you to think door number one, door number two, but not know there's a door number three. And I think that could probably apply to 9/11 to some extent, and other bellwether and pivotal events in American and world history, that kind of propaganda technique. So fake right, fake left, but don't look anywhere else. And so you can go, ladies and gentlemen, those listening live on the archive, you can go to the audio or the video simulcast for November 22nd to hear what we said that day. The video simulcast, like the live real-time ones, are archived at livestream.com/Ryan Avery/stop the presses. Of course, the audio only is here at republicbroadcasting.org and are automatically archived just the same. But Brian, thanks for coming back.
Okay, I do not see myself on my video screen, but I take it that I am here.
Yeah, you're fine. That we had that come up last time. Yep, you're good. Anyway, we had a few little technical glitches right before the show. This is not going to be the last time we cover this subject with Brian. From time to time, we'll be back as we outline this, heading toward the 60-year anniversary that isn't too far away in 2023. So probably every 6 to 8 weeks, at least every 10 weeks or something like that, we'll be revisiting with Brian, because there's a lot to unpack to understand the way this cloak and dagger operation, as we see it, was carried out. And we've carefully looked at evidence in this matter. And we, I'm going to ask the engineer, Ron Avery, who is, like usual, providing the video simulcast of this show. Ron, will we be able at some point, maybe in the last half, to show the Clinton Hill video today, or will that have to wait?
The question was, can we start it halfway through the show?
Yeah, well, would we be able to watch that in this today's show at any point?
Watch what?
The Clinton Hill video.
We can watch that right now. We're ready
okay.
to go.
Oh, I didn't know. Yeah, there was some technical problems before the show, and we're going to be as commercial-free as possible today. So let's get started on this video of Clinton Hill. I believe he was born in North Dakota, if memory serves, and he was in the Army, and he joined the Secret Service, and he's the famous guy who jumped on the back of the Kennedy 100X limo after he heard the first shot. And everybody has seen that. It's a world-famous thing. Let me get this out before we start the video. He's the only person still alive who was in that 100X presidential limo when these events went down. Everyone else is no longer with us. So he's quite the hot potato in terms of his observations. But there are some problems with his observations, and we're going to critique what he has to say on this very recent video, and we'll talk more about our experiences with Clinton Hill after this a little bit, perhaps, but let's go ahead and start that, and there'll be some stops along the way, the first one at about 3:32, so go ahead.
The right side of his face was up. I could see his eyes were fixed. There's a hole in the skull. I could see in that hole there was no brain matter left. It had all been blown out. We were very concerned about it, but we knew we didn't have much of a choice. In this particular instance, going into Texas, the reason for the trip was maximum visibility and maximum exposure for President and Mrs. Kennedy, because they wanted as many people to be up close and personal to them as they possibly could get. And so that was the purpose of the trip. That meant open cars no matter where we went. They asked, the agents were instructed to back off as much as possible. There were times when I got up very, very close, but it was because of the situation that developed. But under normal circumstances, we tried to stay as far away as we could to make them feel like that they were just among their friends and people along the side of the street, and wanted the people inside the street to feel like there was no barrier between them and the President and Mrs. Kennedy.
So it was the president and his wife and Governor Connally and his wife in that car. Where were you and how far away?
That was the presidential car. I was in the immediate car behind him, the follow-up car, which we ran between about 3 to 5 feet between the two cars at all times, no matter what the speed. I was on the left-hand side of the running board of that car. That was also an open car. There were 8 agents in that car and 2 members of President Kennedy's staff, Kenny O'Donnell, his chief of staff, and Dave Powers, his chief personal assistant. I was on the left side of the car on the running board, and as we went through an area called Dealey Plaza, I was scanning the area. It was just a grassy area, and the crowd, which had been very large as we've traveled through Dallas, had dropped off as we approached Dealey Plaza. It was the end of the motorcade, pretty much. We were going to get on an expressway to take the president to a speech site called the Trade Mart. And there was an overpass we were going to have to go under, and I was looking at that, and I noticed there was some police on top, and that was good enough for me. And we noticed, though, as we traveled down the streets of Dallas, that the windows were open on buildings, and people were on fire escapes or on top of buildings, any place they could be to get a better view of the motorcade. And the same was true of the building we passed on the corner of Houston and Elm Street. It was called the Texas School Book Depository. We saw that there were about 4 or 5 windows open in that building, and there were some workmen sitting on a ledge, apparently having lunch, taking a lunch break, watching the motorcade as we approached. And we had turned down on Elm Street, maybe 150 feet, and as I was scanning to my left, I heard this explosive noise from the rear over my right shoulder. I didn't recognize it as a gunshot initially, so I started to turn toward that noise, and I only got as far as the back of the president's car, because I saw the president's reaction, and that's when I realized it had been a gunshot. He grabbed at his throat, and he started to fall to his left.
Okay, Brian, right there, that's the first stop. He grabbed at his throat. Your reaction?
Again, his testimony has changed over the years. There was a Secret Service report, and then there was also the Warren Commission. At no one time during this whole, in the 60s, even in the 70s, he never said, "I saw him grab for his throat." For the Warren Commission, basically, the person asking him the questions said, did he grab for his throat? And all he had could answer was yes, yes, yes. So that he was led through all of his testimony, and nothing was ever said in the Secret Service report of grabbing for his throat. So this is now post, Zapruder film type of testimony, and has nothing, I feel, with connection with reality. That this, based upon the statements that he said in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, let me add that on our last show, November 22nd, we talked about no one saw him grab for his throat. He leaned to his left that day, and this grabbing for his throat would be concocted or contrived later. And I've got the exact testimony in front of me. Arlen Specter said, was there any movement of the president's head or shoulders? Wait a minute, let me get the right spot. Excuse me. Would you tell us with more particularity in what way he grabbed at himself, Mr. Spector, Arlen Spector, who became a Pennsylvania senator, at the time was on the Warren Commission? Again, he asked Clinton Hill in his Warren Commission testimony, would you tell us with more particularity in what way JFK grabbed at himself? And Mr. Hill said he grabbed in this general area. And then Mr. Spector replied, you are indicating that your right hand is coming up to your paws, to your throat, to the throat. Mr. Hill then said, yes, sir. See, so there's a little bit of leading the witness there. And yeah. then interestingly, right in that same conversation, Gerald Ford said the following. Mr. Spector said, now, did the impact on the president's head occur simultaneously before or after the second noise which you described? And we'll talk about that second noise a little bit later. Here's what's interesting. Mr. Hill said, simultaneously. So what that means is the second noise that Clinton Hill heard being simultaneously with the so-called impact on the headshot, that means that this, the noise he heard, the second shot, and whatever happened to the president's head were two separate events. He said they happened simultaneously. He didn't say they were one and the same thing. But that's very interesting.
Well, it's also too...
And then Representative Ford adds...
Yeah, and also, too, is that his vantage point of being on that running board of the Secret Service car, there's really no way he could see JFK grab for his throat. He's off to JFK's left from the back, and you could really not see him grab for anything, just like everybody else. So first off, even if JFK did grab for his throat, I feel it was almost impossible for him to see that in the position he was on the running board on the Secret Service car. So again, he is now making up types of things to go along with the Zapruder narrative.
Yeah, certainly he would see very little, if anything. He might have seen a, you know, like a general notion of something. But anyway, adding what Representative Ford said, more this kind of leading the witness, did you see the president put his hands to his throat and chest while you were still on the follow-up car or after you had left it? And Mr. Hill said, as I was leaving. And that is one of the reasons I jumped, because I saw him grab himself and pitch forward and to the left. I knew something was wrong. That's what he actually said. But Representative Ford is making this presupposition that the hands were put to the throat.
Yeah, and then see, it doesn't make any sense. That's kind of impossible, where he says he turns to look up to where the shot was coming from, and then he comes back and he sees going to the throat. That's an impossibility. He either looked up at the school book depository and then looked over. By that time, JFK, if he had grabbed for his throat, couldn't have, his hands had already been down. And so this whole thing of mishmash, it does not make any sense at all.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. What you're saying, and we'll resume the video in a minute, what you're saying is that would have already been done. That event would have already been over before he left the running board of the Queen Mary.
And also, too, is if he was turning to his right to look up to the school book depository, I'm sure he had to stay there for 1 or 2 seconds at least. And then when he brought his vision back to the presidential car, that event of him grabbing for his throat was already done. It was already through, if he grabbed for his throat. So again, there's just this whole mishmash of contradictions and basically lies.
Yeah, he would have left the Queen Mary only after that event, only after that first shot.
Right.
And then JFK's hands would have been elsewhere because he was already slumping to his left, which everybody did see.
Right.
And so, there's a timing and sequence problem there on top of the two instances when it's clear that they were leading the witness because he wasn't absolutely sure, it appeared, strongly appeared, what JFK actually did with his hand.
Yeah, and that's where, again...
Sort of speaking in generalities, and they filled in the... Yeah.
Yeah, and again, also, this is, we've pointed out one inconsistency here. And if you'll stay with us, we will point out many, many more.
Yeah, okay, let's continue the video then. That was an important one. Go ahead.
He had a back brace on, which prevented him from really bending much forward, but also immediately in front of him was seated Governor Connally in a jump seat, and the back of that jump seat was almost up against the knees of President Kennedy. So he started to fall to his left, and when I then realized this was a gunshot, so I jumped from my position, and I ran toward the presidential car with the intent of getting up on top of the back to prevent it, to provide a shield there for President and Mrs. Kennedy. Now, when I ran, I had to go between a motorcycle officer on his motorcycle and the car I was on. There was engine noise, and they told me later there was a second shot at that time, but I never heard that shot. And as I approached the car, just as I was getting there, there was another shot that was fired. That one I heard and I felt, because at that time the president had fallen a little bit farther to his left, and his head was way down, like kind of like this. And that shot hit him in the back of the head, and then it erupted out of the upper right quadrant, just above the ear. And it blew.
Okay, right there, Brian, what's your reaction there?
Well, first off, so we now have the photos, and everybody has the photos. Basically, there's many people have the photos of the Zapruder film, and they show that during all the shots that were fired, the back of JFK's head stayed totally 100% preserved and pristine. So, this is just, again, one more lie.
Yeah, I'll add that we showed it on the November 22nd, the first installment of this, ladies and gentlemen, those listening live and on the archive. And again, you can see that video simulcast of that first JFK show at livestream.com/Ron Avery/stop the presses. We showed a photo on that episode, and it is frame 313. And if you blow it up, the back of JFK's head, and evidently the entirety of it, but definitely the back, remained intact. It is completely unambiguous. It's beyond argument. So this is an area where people's emotions and propaganda get in the way.
Well, also, this is the point where cognitive dissonance also really kicks in, because this is just so much information for a lot of people, then they just dismiss the whole thing. And a lot of JFK quote researchers, this is where it really starts to get, you know, very bad for them, and then they go into cognitive dissonance, being basically just ignore everything. Don't try to reply. Don't do anything. Just ignore.
Yeah, and I'm going to add now, and this will probably be repeated later, what Clinton Hill says now, these days, is the impact was like the sound of a melon shattering onto cement. And he told this to a UK paper, adding that the president's blood and parts of his skull splattered all over his clothes, face, and hair. So Clint Hill has told the press, including in the UK, not only that it sounded like a melon splattering or shattering onto cement, but that blood and parts of JFK's skull splattered all over Clint Hill's clothes, his clothes, and face and hair. And early on, he never said anything like that that I ever saw, and we've looked at a lot of sources. But when you look at what he told the Warren Commission, the difference is like night and day. And that is, let me get this right, and this is very important, it'll be repeated later. I jumped from the car realizing that something was wrong and ran to the presidential limousine. Just about as I reached it, there was another sound, which was different than the first sound or first shot. I think I described it in my statement, that's the previous statements that Secret Service agents filled out, as though someone was shooting a revolver into a hard object, and it seemed to have some type of an echo. Now
that's
that is completely...
Melon.
Say that again?
That's not a watermelon or a melon.
That's not a melon, yeah, being shattered onto cement. That is a fundamentally different thing, and I go by the principle, and most investigators go by the principle, I know you do, Brian, that generally speaking, the first testimony after an event is the one to rely on when memories have not faded and everything is kind of imprinted on your mind. So I'm going by the principle that what he told the Warren Commission And he alluded to the fact that he put the same information in a previous statement. That information, I believe, and I have every reason to believe, is what he really saw and heard, and that the melon thing is just, I don't know if you could attribute that to a fading memory, but I think it would take much more than a fading memory to describe something in such a fundamentally different way.
Yeah, and again, that's quite the difference between a melon thumping and a bullet hitting a hard object.
Yes, and we'll talk about the significance of that sound of a revolver into a hard object, and it seemed to have some type of an echo with regards to the trunk of the 100X. We talked about it on November 22nd. We'll talk about it again before today's show ends. And we're trying to get through most of this video. I'm going to check the time. We've got a little bit of time. Let's go ahead and resume the video.
Move that portion of the skull, which was still attached to the scalp, forward like a flap, kind of. And out of that wound gushed blood and bone fragments and brain matter all over the back of the car, all over me, all over Mrs. Kennedy.
Okay, maybe we have another.
If you look at pictures of Jackie, she has almost no blood on the upper portion of her body. He's saying she got splattered, and that is completely 100% a lie. That's provable 100% lie. She was pristine from the waist up.
That's right. The only discoloration on the pink suit with the pillbox hat was seen in a photo when she's standing next to RFK when they arrived in Bethesda, Maryland for this nebulous autopsy. You can see some discoloration on her skirt below the waist. But in the photo, we're not showing it today, but it's a very famous photo of her standing next to LBJ when he was sworn in as president on Air Force One before they left left field. Her pink suit was pristine. And Penn and Teller did that test shooting a melon with a Carcano rifle, and the impact of the bullet, if it happened like we're told it did on that day, the impact of the bullet would have practically taken her hat off, too, because that's what happened in the Penn and Teller experiment. So her hat stayed on. Her hat and her suit and her upper face and body would have been full of blood and bone tissue. And now Clint Hill is saying his clothes and face and body were full of blood and bone tissue.
And that's totally 100% a lie.
We're gonna continue after the bottom of the hour. We're gonna continue this video. I'm just telling Ron right from where we left off. So don't lose that video. We'll pick it up, but we'll discuss it a little bit more before we hit the bottom of the hour. Then we'll pick up the video after the bottom of the hour and a couple of important still frames. There's a lot to unpack here, but yeah, so you've got this situation now to kind of recap where. He hears the first shot and then tries to say nowadays that simultaneously he saw Kennedy's reaction to that, or rather he didn't see Kennedy's reaction to that first shot until he got off the Queen Mary, when it could only have been when he was still on the Queen Mary simultaneously, because it would happen in such an instant. So you have that as one big contradiction in terms of sequence and logic and things like that. And then you have, of course, the biggie, which is now he talks about a cement, a melon shattering against cement when the real story initially, right after these things happened, was the sound of a revolver shooting into a hard object, and it seemed to have some kind of echo. Now, to have an echo requires a chamber. You don't, you have a lot of motorcycle noise, and you have a lot of people cheering. It's not just going to be the echo of the buildings, because if it was the buildings echoing, you would have heard a similar echo from all the shots. So this one shot that had that echo had to be happening in a unique place for it to have such a distinctly different sound. And so we have that contradiction too, the mythical melon versus the reality of what he heard and how he described it to the Warren Commission. And so, any other observations, Brian? We're going to kind of
keep moving.
Yeah, let me see where we're at. Well, we do have a few minutes. Ron, if you're able, go ahead and resume the video. We'll watch another minute or two. Go ahead. Or go to the next stop. Excuse me. Go to the next stop. 503.
When I started to get up in the car, Mrs. Kennedy came up in the trunk. She was trying to grab some of that material that had erupted out of the president's head. And she managed to get some of it in her hand. I grabbed her and put her in the back seat. When I did that, the president's body fell to his left into her lap. The right side of his face was up. I could see his eyes were...
Okay. That's at the six-minute mark.
A hole in the skull. I could see in that hole there was no brain matter.
No, keep going.
Her left. It had all been blown out. I assumed that he had passed. He was dead. So I turned and gave my thumbs down to the other agents on the car behind because they hadn't had a chance to react like I did because they turned towards the noise too for guys on the other side of the car, which meant they turned away from the president just at the moment that he was going to be shot.
Mark, I cannot see the numbers anymore. This stuff happened, shows a different display every time. This time I have a band of stuff at the bottom that's blocking out the numbers.
By the time they turned back, I was already at the car. Too late for them. They couldn't do anything.
Okay, let's stop right there.
Then?
That's good to stop right there. Here, Brian, we have his body fell to his left into her lap. And
well, he's also saying that Jackie crawled out on the back of the car and he put her back into the car. And again, that's also very questionable because none of the eyewitnesses saw that. And so that was also another fakery of the Zapruder film and also some a still picture that was taken by a photographer, a still frame, and that's also now been brought into question of whether that was also doctored. So the whole, again, we get into another, how you know, put this, a twilight zone where nobody has seen, the eyewitnesses did not see Jackie go out onto the trunk of the car and did not see Clint take her back in, but yet that's in a still picture, and it's also in video. And so that's, you know, again, we're it's just one more lie on top of the other lies, etc.
Yeah, I'll add, when we did My God, I'm Hit, the book and the video, which you can see at mygodimhit.com, My God, I am, no apostrophe, mygodimhit.com. And it'll lead you to an IMDb page. There was some nuance there because some people believe she did crawl out on the trunk of the car, and some people believe that could have been some movie work, you might say, some editing. But one thing's for sure, whatever happened in that spot, one thing is absolutely clear when you look at the Zapruder film in areas where it clearly was not doctored, because they wouldn't want to over-doctor this thing. You can see that there was not material all over the trunk like Clinton Hill and some others have described. He's saying that material was all over him, all over Jackie, and all over the trunk. When what looks like Jackie on the trunk, when you see that, there's a single distinct object he's reaching. One thing. We'll be back with more on this right after our break. Stay tuned.
The truth! You can't handle the truth!
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Real news, real talk, real people. Because you can handle the truth.
What would you say if I told you we have a new tool that will increase production and lower maintenance costs for your meat processing company, and it would pay for itself in just 6 weeks?
When pigs fly!
The new EaseOff Model EZ4 replaces old spring-style carcass droppers and is faster, safer, and more reliable. The EaseOff lowers or lifts 1,000 pounds to or from your rail automatically using our remote control.
Sounds expensive. Can I afford it?
Can you afford not to try the EaseOff? It installs fast with just 3 bolts in place of your current dropper. The effortless operation will reduce fatigue and injuries, speed up your line, eliminate downtime, and increase profit.
How can I order my Ease Off?
Go to easeoff.com, EAZEOFF.com, and hurry, because we are offering $200 off on the new Easy 4 for a limited time. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too. Ease Off LLC, Summersville, Missouri, 417-932-6419.
Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we have been building our online store. While we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country, here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store. Your support of this network, plus products at the best prices, is a win-win situation. Check out our new store. Go to our website, republicbroadcasting.org, and click on the online store located at the top of our website. Together, we can continue to grow RBN and help our listeners prepare for the future. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on our online store or call us.
800-724-2719, extension 3. 800-724-2719, extension 3.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT-TODAY.
Yeah, from a little big horn to the Rio Grande, it seems we've seen the last lemonade stand. Well, all the flea markets and the paper routes, if you can't trade in bulk, you get muscle.
Now, welcome to the second half of Stop the Presses. Today, the 8th of December, 2021, my return guest, Brian David Anderson of California. He's a health practitioner out there, and I've worked with him over 10 years on an alternative view, to say the least, of what happened on Elm Street in the town of Dallas outside the Texas School Book Depository on November 22, 1963, what went on with JFK, what really happened, and we believe beyond a reasonable doubt that he did not die that day, that it was a fake assassination, abdication set up, and that he was whisked out of the country at some point. And, of course, the way the media was tightly controlled before people had cameras everywhere in their cell phones, it would have been relatively easy to pull off a cloak and dagger operation like this. We're not trying to unpack the whole thing on one show. We did this November 22nd this year. We'll be doing more as 2023 and the 60th anniversary of these events approaches. And another point of clarity, and correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, and this is just to keep people grounded in what we're unpacking here. The conventional view, and we're going to watch more of the video in just a minute, and I think we'll just go ahead and watch the entirety or most of the rest of that video, Ron, without any stops, because I have a script here anyway. But the conventional view is that the first shot was the magic bullet, then there was a miss, then there was a fatal shot, correct? That's what we've been told.
Yes, that's the line of events, yeah.
Right, but what we're saying is the first shot hit JFK only in the shoulder. The second would have been for Connally. There was no way they had the magic bullet as the first shot that hit both JFK and Connally. So we say shoulder, Connally, and then the device, the incendiary device that was set off near JFK's head to simulate a impact of a rifle shot. And so, once again, conventional is magic bullet, then a miss, then the fatal shot to the head. Our view is the shoulder shot to JFK, Then they poked Connolly to distract him and then set off the device. And simultaneously with that device, we believe the echo and the sound of a pistol hitting a metal object was something inside the trunk, inside a secret compartment in the 100X. We'll talk about that a little bit more toward the end of the show. But that's a very pivotal thing right there.
I just have a real brief statement, and I feel hopefully that this is to Clint Hill. I'm looking directly right now on the camera. Clint Hill, it is my belief that you weren't part of any of the things that what Mark described. I really feel that when you stepped off of that Secret Service car and onto the back of the limousine, is that you injected yourself into a plan. I don't think you were part of it. And you then had to be party to it. And in many ways, I have sympathies for that. But yet at the same time, now take responsibility and tell the truth.
Yeah, well spoken. Well spoken, Brian. I think that needed to be said. He was supposed to stay, we believe, on the running board of the Queen Mary and not jump into history, as it were, and see something he wasn't supposed to see, an operation that would not have happened, would have happened without anyone knowing it were he not there. And again, he's the only person still alive who was in that car. So he's a pivotal person, to say the least. Let's go ahead and play a little bit more video, and we'll round out our comments and our observations as much as we can.
Was it you that gave the order to go to the hospital?
Well, I screamed at the driver to get to the hospital, but the agent in the right front seat, he told the driver to hit it, get out of there, because that was what we were supposed to evacuate the area. And so, we were not familiar with the Dallas at all, and so the chief of police, Chief Curry, got in front of us in his car, and he led us to Parkland Hospital.
How long of a drive is that?
It took us about 4 minutes to get there, and we were running above 70 miles an hour as we traveled down this Stemmons Freeway. And I was lying up on back of the top seat, of the back seat. I kind of wedged myself in between the two sides of the car by hooking my leg on the right side and holding on with my hands on the left side so I wouldn't slide off, because we had to make some turns, and it was a little precarious at a couple of points.
What's happening in the car at this time? What are the other people doing?
Nobody is saying anything. At first, Mrs. Kennedy made some comments. She said, Jack, what have they done? They've shot his head off. I have his brains in my hand. I love you, Jack. And that was all she said. And then we raced to the hospital. When we got to the hospital, they had been alerted that we were coming by the chief of police. But there was nobody there outside to meet us at all, so... The agent in the lead car jumped out, ran in. He found that there was a tenant trying to bring out two gurneys at the same time. He got caught in the doorway and couldn't do it. So he grabbed one of the gurneys and brought it out. And then the attendant brought the other one out. But we had to remove the governor from the car before we could do anything for the president because of the way the car was configured. So we got the governor up and put him on a gurney, and they rushed him into the emergency room. Then we were going to work and help the president get out, just take the president, put him on a gurney. But Mrs. Kennedy had a hold of him, and she wouldn't let go. So I pleaded with her. I said, please, Mrs. Kennedy, let us help the president. And never got no response at all. And then I said that again, and I still didn't get any response. And then I thought to myself, I know what's wrong. I've been with her over 3 years now. I know her pretty well. She didn't want anybody to see the condition he's in, because it was horrible. And so I took off my suit coat. I covered up his head and his upper back. As soon as I did that, she let go. We lifted him up, put him on a gurney, ran into the emergency room, put him in trauma room one.
Hey, Ryan, can we stop
and
there?
I said, well, how long will that take? They said, oh, emergency room, put him in trauma room one.
Can we stop there?
I'm trying somehow.
Yeah, you got it. That's a good place to intervene. We may not be able to get through this whole video today, Brian, but a couple things. This is just a sundry item, but it's worth mentioning. He said they went about 70 miles an hour to Parkland Hospital on Stemmons Freeway, a.k.a. I-35. But he told the Warren Commission between 60 and 65 miles an hour. just for the record, every mile an hour makes a difference, especially between 5 and 10 miles an hour difference. That's a anomaly, to say the least. And also
the 100X limousine could go very easily with that crew on it, 95, 100 miles an hour, easily.
Right, and we believe, strongly believe, that they needed to go slow enough to carry out the body switch. And, of course, we need to explain that a little bit now, that we believe, and we have evidence for that, and logically speaking, that there was a secret compartment in the trunk of the 100X and a JFK lookalike. Remember, there's been presidential doubles and doppelgangers, I think they call them, going back, they say, to Ulysses S. Grant. Most presidents have had a double for decoy purposes, especially in case of war or insurrection or unusual events. So JFK's official double or someone who looked a lot like him would have been in that trunk with a handler, and that handler would have applied the wounds to that JFK double, and those are the same wounds that showed up at Trauma Room 1 at Parkland Hospital, and that's who they operated on. And the wounds were a specific way, and they were consistent with how that would have been done in the secret compartment within that large trunk of the 100X presidential limousine. And so right there, there's another rub there, Brian. First of all, he says that Mrs. Kennedy had JFK's brains in my hand. Well, JFK would have been laying in her lap with his brains facing upward. And earlier he said that all his brains in that cavity were blown out.
Yeah. Again, so there's just more inconsistencies there.
Yeah, it's sketchy. But here's the part that I caught, and you and I never caught this before, Brian. There's always something new. He said that Chief Curry, in the car ahead of the presidential limo, called ahead to Parkland Hospital that the President of the United States had been shot, and then he says, but no one was waiting outside Parkland.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. That does not make any sense at all.
That just doesn't happen.
Yeah, because they had a good 10 minutes at least, a good 7 minutes to get that prepared and get that down. Now, the question being that we're 1963, so was there a direct communications with the emergency room? Were they talking directly to the ER or not? I mean, that would give them a little bit of a break there.
Right. But it seems highly unlikely, and we never caught that before. So I'm only going to put that out there as a question, and because we hadn't seen it before. And so another thing is, and this is another new realization, because we've always had this over the 10-plus years we've been investigating this. He says he put his coat over Kennedy's head when they arrived at Parkland in order for Jackie to let go emotionally and physically. But he had just said that when they were on the streets of Dallas on Elm Street, that there was blood and brains all over his coat. Would he put a coat full of blood and brains over the president's head because he thought the president's head looked gory? Well, why put a jacket full of those same blood and brains over the head of the president, because that too would be gory?
Well, that's also, now this gives it that did he actually put his jacket over her? There's always been this doubt that that's happened, and that actually there was another jacket that was the backup that he was going to change for when he went to the to speech right after going down Elm Street, and they had a jacket waiting for him in the trunk, which meant the only way that he'd get that is when somehow they got into the trunk. They had that spare jacket, and the spare jacket is what was put over, because the one of JFK's favorite jackets was the pinstripe. And we have another guy by the name of Aubrey Reich, who said that the jacket that he saw on the floor of Parkland had a pinstripe. And basically, if you look at this jacket that Clinton Hill is wearing now, that's very similar to what they had back in 63. There was no pinstripe. So again, that is another anomaly of whether he really did put his jacket on. There's really good doubt that that happened.
Yeah, there's among many biographers, there's one particular biographer, I'm not thinking of his name. He said that JFK, generally speaking, changed clothes 3 times a day. And yeah, JFK was not wearing a pinstripe. Secret Service agents would not wear pinstripe suits. That's considered dressy and kind of like you're going out to the ball or dinner. Professionally, they didn't wear a pinstripe suit. So where'd the pinstripe suit come from? And for clarity, for those listening live and on the archive, Aubrey Reich was a top-notch ambulance driver. And in the Oliver Stone movie, he is the one depicted seeing an epileptic fit victim, a person having an epileptic type fit, right before the motorcade got to the Houston Street, Elm Street axis. And that person had an epileptic fit, and that drew Aubrey Reich, a highly competent, razor-sharp ambulance driver, and his partner, nicknamed Peanuts. It drew them out of that area. And that's depicted in the Oliver Stone JFK film. And when they got to, when they got this epileptic victim to Parkland Hospital, they put him in a waiting bay, and Aubrey Reich, this ambulance driver, went and got some cigarettes out of a vending machine and turned around, and that person that had that epileptic fit was gone, never to be seen again. And so it's very clear, and it strongly suggests at the very least, that they wanted to draw that ambulance unit, which is the O'Neill Ambulance Service, very well known at that time. They wanted to draw it out of Dealey Plaza, because what Aubrey Reich would have done is, had he seen this happen to the presidential limo, he would have pulled his ambulance right next to the presidential limo, and the whole gaff would have been blown.
Right.
So they had to get him out of there, and that's one area where Oliver Stone's movie is accurate. There's a couple other areas.
That's where there's a couple things where Oliver Stone is like, he dropped these tidbits, and he actually, either the not maybe Stone himself, but the people really doing the movie, they dropped these things in just as, you know, playing with the audience. If you had to really know the background to know why they did that.
That's correct. But at any rate, Aubrey Reich saw the pinstripe jacket that neither Clint Hill or JFK himself was wearing when everything started out that day, coming out of Love Field, having left Fort Worth and other Texas cities before that, coming into Dallas's Love Field. So where did the pinstripe jacket come from, right? JFK wasn't wearing it. Clint Hill wasn't wearing it. And Aubrey Reich also told you, Brian, and we have to get through this. This is important. When you asked him, and I interviewed Aubrey Reich too in Plano, Texas in 2009, and Aubrey Reich was one of those people, and other people that knew him also said this. Aubrey Reich never embellished. He always told the same exact thing. His memory was rock solid, almost photographic, and you could depend on what Aubrey Reich said. And we weren't the only ones to say that. But he told you, and he told me, that he never saw Clint Hill with his jacket off. And in fact, he never saw any Secret Service agents with their jacket off, exposing their very bright white shirts with their gun holsters right here. Do you recall that?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, like he was a very key eyewitness. If anybody would know any of that, that would be him, that he saw no Secret Service agents with their jackets off.
Right, and he was all over the place. He was outside waiting by the ambulance bay, and then he went inside, and I remember him saying that he saw Mrs. Kennedy waiting outside of Trauma Room 1, and he went through, you know, various things, various observations.
What we do is, again, he exposes another lie by Clint Hill.
Yes, yeah, we don't mean to be unkind, but we do mean to be on target with our comments. And like you said, we can appeal to Clint Hill's better senses to come clean in his latter years, in his sunset years, to break the cycle of these kind of cloak and dagger operations, that what they've done is they've moved our country out of a republic into empire. They've basically, at least to a large extent, basically dissolved our republican structure of government that our original founders gave us, and moved us into empire, and events like this are the leverage that make that happen. 9/11 is another false
PTSD.
Flag event.
Just say constantly that again. Putting people in PTSD.
Right, soldiers aren't the only ones that get post-traumatic stress syndrome. That's right. The entire, via the mass media cartel, the entire population is given a form or degree of PTSD, maybe not as bad as soldiers are in direct combat, but it's a very similar psychological effect, that's true. Let's listen to a little bit more, and we'll do a wrap. Maybe about 3 minutes of video, and we'll do a wrap.
And then you waited with her?
Yeah, I waited in there. My assistant stayed immediately beside her. My supervisor asked me to open a phone line to the White House in Washington. So I asked the emergency room personnel to use one of their phones. They gave me a phone to use. We had a White House switchboard in Dallas that the White House Communications set up. I got a hold of that switchboard and told them to connect me to the White House and keep the line open. And so I was briefing my supervisor in Washington about what had happened, and the operator cut in. And he said, Mr. Hill, the Attorney General wants to talk to you. So the Attorney General was Robert Kennedy, the President's brother. He said, Clint, he said, what's going on down there? So I explained to him that there had been a shooting. The President was had been hit. Governor Connally had been hit. We were in the hospital. They were doing what they could to try and help the two gentlemen. He said, well, how bad is it? Now, I didn't want to tell Robert Kennedy that his brother was dead. So I just said, it's as bad as it can get. And with that, he just hung up the phone. So then at 1 o'clock, the doctor came out of the trauma room and said, I'm sorry, but the president is dead. There's nothing more we can do. When that happened, the chief of staff came to me and said, Clint, we want to transport the president's body back to Washington. Can you arrange to get us a casket? So I got a hold of the administrator of the hospital, and they put me in touch with a mortuary, ordered a casket, had it brought to the hospital, brought in, and they were preparing the president's body to be placed in the casket when one of the coroners came in. And he said, what are you guys doing? And we said, we're preparing to transport the body back to Washington. He said, you can't leave with the hospital. We said, why not? He said, because there's a law in Texas that says that a homicide victim has to be autopsied before he's released. And we said, well, how long will that take? They said, oh, an hour, maybe 2 hours, maybe a day. We said, no, that's not acceptable.
Okay, we'll cut there. That's enough for the time we have. We got about maybe 4 to 5 minutes for the show. We need the time to sort this out, Brian, and I've got a little bit more about what he says right after this in my notes here. But there's a lot more to this than he says on this video. When the Texas law forbade taking the president's body out of there before there was an autopsy, of course that happened. What Clint Hill does not say in this video is that there was quite an altercation as local officials tried to stop them from removing that body.
They actually took guns.
They actually had to draw their guns because Texans didn't want the law to be broken. They wanted the ones that had authority and were there at least wanted the body to stay there so it could be examined locally according to Texas law before it was taken out of there. Another thing that is a question is, why would you order an Elgin casket, $4,500, $5,000 or so in 1963 dollars, the most expensive casket for a body that's still bleeding out somewhat, and put it in there? Now, a nurse wrapped it in blankets, or sheets rather, to supposedly try and keep the back of the head that Robert McClellan knew was oozing out here. And this is the body of the switchman, not JFK himself. And what's interesting here is that Aubrey Reich, the crack ambulance driver we talked about earlier, he's the one that was directly involved in putting the body in the casket, and he described something very interesting. There was no shoulder wound like we knew JFK's body had, and there was no back of the neck wound like they claim or anything like that. And so And JFK's head was intact on the Z film, the Zapruder film, and yet this body did have a head wound in the back. And then Kenneth Salyers, the youngest doctor at Parkland at that time, saw the upper scalp wound here, which is the entrance wound. And so what Aubrey Reich saw was, as he put it in the casket, was the kind of body that would not have been JFK's. JFK was shown in the Z film not to have a head wound. This body did have a head wound. JFK was shown in the Z film, was witnessed by Glenn Bennett out of the Secret Service agent out of the Queen Mary, was witnessed as being hit in the shoulder, and this body at Parkland, as it was being put into the casket, did not have the bullet wound to the shoulder. So had it been JFK, it would have just had a bullet wound to the shoulder, which wouldn't have been fatal anyway. So to make it simple, the body put into that casket did not have the one wound that we knew JFK had, and it did have a head wound that we know he didn't get.
And one more thing is that the neck wound was, again, when they put the tracheotomy in right before that, it was done by Charles Baxter, and he adamantly said that this wound was entry. So you had a wound entry to the head, and then you had a wound entry. Actually, what happened in the trunk is it was shot in the throat first to keep the person silent, and then took the .45 out, shot the victim in the head. It went through the head, and that was that hard object. It went through the floorboard, and the echo was the ricochet on the street. And that that slug was actually recovered in the grass.
Right, but an FBI agent standing next to Dallas cop Buddy Walters found that .45 pistol slug, not a rifle bullet, in the grass along Elm Street, right where you would expect to find it after the JFK double was shot in the trunk, as you say, through the upper head. That's the entry wound. The big back, large wound out of the back of the head, that's the exit wound. That's the one that Robert McClellan at the gurney in the trauma room one on the operating table, that's the one that he felt, and that's where the blood came out. And that blood was oozing as it was put into the Elgin casket by Aubrey Reich. But that body did not have a back wound or shoulder wound, which JFK would have had, because it was not JFK, as we postulate and we believe beyond a shadow of a doubt is true. So Aubrey Reich was a key person. And there's one other thing worth mentioning. JFK owned a very slender, expensive watch, and he wore it in several places in a more social nature, but we did not see any evidence, looking at dozens and dozens of photos, that he wore that slender, skinny watch that day. And yet, the body that was taken into trauma room one and operated on was wearing a watch. And the nurse attested, I forget her name, but she attested to cutting the watch off. So there was a mistake there too. And I think we're running out of time, but we've
got one more last message. Clint, get righteous and tell the truth.
There you go. Thanks for listening to another episode of this. There'll be more, maybe one more before this year ends, certainly in early 2022 as 2023 and the 60th anniversary approach. Lots to unpack here. That's why I'm talking like a machine gun, you might say. Thanks, Brian, for being on the show.
Fantastic. Very good again.
Okay, thanks. And thanks, Ron, for helping us out, getting through the technical hurdles. And we'll see everybody next time, Friday and beyond, on Stop the Presses. Have a great day.
Have you ever needed to make a phone call but didn't want the person you're calling to know that it was you on the other end? Have you ever needed to make a call and wanted to keep your phone number and location private? Well, now you can with PatriotPhone.com. PatriotPhone.com will enable you to make unlimited calls anonymously. That's right, unlimited anonymous phone calls to anywhere in the U.S. and 36 countries around the world. Our most popular phone plan includes unlimited calls, your own phone number, voicemail, call forwarding, and many other great features. Visit PatriotPhone.com to get your own phone number in any state and take back control of your phone calls. PatriotPhone.com also allows you to record your calls and access all of your phone records online. PatriotPhone.com works with iPhones, Android-based phones, and Windows computers. Protect your privacy and your freedom with unlimited anonymous telephone service from PatriotPhone.com. Today, that's PatriotPhone.com.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.